This is an interview with Mr. Mike Dinn, who has followed a distinguished career in the space tracking and related fields and is currently the director of the Tibumbilla Deep Space Communication Complex. This interview is taking place today, the 29th of May 1994, in Mr. Dinn's residence in Canberra. Mike, can we begin with where you were born and how you started and how you got into the industry?
I was born in 1933 in Bradford, Yorkshire, in the north of England, and did my primary school, secondary school and tertiary training in that town. I did an engineering degree at what was the local technical college in those days. It's now the Bradford University. And specialise in electronics, communications, electronics, also power, etc. And I finished that in 1955. I then did a two-year graduate apprenticeship with EMI at Hayes, Middlesex, England. This was a prerequisite to membership, the Institute of Electrical Engineers. At the end of that, I then worked another 2 years with EMI, mostly on airborne radar and on what was then a classified radar system for the V bombers in the British system. I got married in 1958. Again, Trudy and I both lived in Ealing. For about a year or so. Then we moved back to my hometown of Bradford and I worked for English Electric for about 18 months in their aircraft equipment division, designing constant frequency AC power systems for aircraft. I was happy to be back in my hometown, but the job wasn't very interesting, so I happened by chance to notice an advert for a job in a place called Australia in regard to aircraft flight testing. So I put in an application for the job, had an interview in Australia House. After the interview, did not expect to get the job, but got a long story short, I was offered this position at RAAF Laverton, southwest of Melbourne, in charge of flight test instrumentation. So in 1960, October 1960, we sailed from Southampton on a three-year contract, I might say, to work with the Australian Department of Supply, seconded to the Air Force, Department of Air as it was then. And we arrived at Port Melbourne and ended up living initially at Werribee, and I worked at Laverton for 5 years, a very interesting period. The Australian Air Force decided to buy the Mirage 3 aircraft during this period, so I ended up 2 or 3 months in France planning the instrumentation for the Mirage. I'd previously had a couple of periods working in France when I was with EMI, so I had some French experience. So the job was interesting, and again, whilst there, I saw an advert for a place for Carnarvon for a tracking station. And I wrote out an application to go and work for the contractor Carnarvon, but never actually posted it.
Was this before Carnarvon began?
This was as Carnarvon was opening up.
As it was opening up.
Which would have been, I don't know, 62, 3, 63. Somewhere about like that. I didn't follow it up, but I sort of kept my eyes and ears open. I remember reading an article in the Bulletin, somewhere must have been in about 64, describing what was coming at Honeysuckle Creek. Anyway, I eventually saw an advert for the deputy station director at Honeysuckle Creek, which I applied for. Had an interview for by Kirkpatrick, who ran, I think, what was called the American Project Division at WRE in those days. Again, didn't expect to get the job. It was the most rigorous interview I've ever had. But at the time, he said, if you don't get the one at Honeysuckle, you'd see the one at Tibumbilla. I said, oh, yeah. Anyway, eventually they came back and offered me the job at Tibumbilla. So I, after effectively 5 years at Laverton, I drove up here to Canberra on Decimal Currency Day, 14th of February 1966, and joined, well, Bob Leslie, as it happens, was in hospital at that time, in Canberra Hospital.
He was the director.
Bob Leslie was the director, the original director of the Canberra facility. He'd taken the original team over to Goldstone in the US to accept all the equipment, bring it back and install it at Tidbinbilla. So I first met Bob Leslie in Royal Canberra Hospital. He'd pulled both Achilles tendons on a cricket match that had been played on there was a concrete strip right where the 70-metre antenna is now. So Bob was ordered combat when I first arrived. he told me that I'd be, as deputy director in those days, I would be actually running the operations, sitting on the operations desk and directing operations in real time.
Did you replace somebody? Or
no, Bob, up to that point, Bob Leslie himself had done the real-time operations job. Also bear in mind, there weren't that many spacecraft flying. All that Tidbinbilla had tracked since its opening, and I can't remember exactly when its opening was Mariner 4. And then Pioneer 6 was launched in November 1965, just two or three months before I arrived. And that was being tracked most days, but there was only a single spacecraft. But the station was big job was working up to support Surveyor.
This was before the days of full-time shift, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was just moving towards it, mind you. The recognition was upcoming that there was going to be need to be a 24-hour staffing, but it was only just coming towards it because Surveyor had not been launched. Surveyor wasn't launched till the May of 66. And also, when I arrived, the building of the wing onto Tidbinbilla to house the manned spaceflight network Apollo equipment had just started. Initially, Tidbinbilla was built purely for the deep space net tracking, but NASA decided to add a wing onto each of the three 85-foot antenna sites, Canberra, Madrid and Goldstone. And so that was just started as I arrived. There was to be a single door between the wing and the deep space side, and a big switch and two keys. And there was because this was into NASA politics at work. JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratories of California Institute of Technology, ran the deep space network. The Goddard Space Flight Center ran the manned space flight network. So they were coexisting on the one site, sharing buildings and infrastructure, and actually sharing the antenna and the front end equipments. And so each was jealous of their responsibilities and authorities. And the wing had to be designed with only one door, which could be locked between the two parts. Anyway, we chose to ignore that. But that was the NASA's Goddard's desires.
What about the staff? Well, there was a special staff for the wing, which was to support the honeysuckle.
Well, Goddard wanted that. Goddard wanted a separate staff. And Bob Leslie, give him his due, said rubbish. Won't be. It'll be an integrated facility. We will have, though, a separate identifiable deputy director, and that's how Don Gray came over from Woomera to join Tidbinbilla. So I was on board as the deputy responsible for deep space missions. Don Gray came on board as the deputy responsible for the manned flight side. And there were one or two other people who did specialise on the manned flight operations, but mostly people were interchangeable because it wasn't that different. The manned space flight network used the JPL designed S-band transmit receive system, right. Doppler extract system ranging, and so the technologies were in some cases the same, most cases identical. The operational philosophies were fairly similar, although manned flight was a world all of its own. Nevertheless, deep space in those days was a great deal of real-time operations, real-time commanding, real-time monitoring of telemetry. So there were no problem whatsoever in operating in this integrated manner.
Because the manned space flight was much more stringent because there was life at stake.
Well, it was more stringent, but you can't get more stringent than people doing their job conscientiously. What the Wayman flight differed from deep space was in the quantity of redundancies, using that word in the American manner, i.e. there were so many backups, alternates and spares, such that the chances of any one item failing, jeopardizing a mission or a life was nil. You had to get several failures before you even started getting a problem. But
this was where you made the statement that 5% of the prime parts of Apollo were used, and the rest of it was sitting back waiting for something to go wrong.
Yeah, going forward a few years, I happened to sit in at Houston on one day when they were doing launch simulations, Apollo launch simulations, and it was fascinating. They'd start the launch clock at launch minus 3, take it up through a simulated launch, usually with a simulated fault, make the decisions, have a debrief for about 10 minutes, then repeat it. And it really hit me that the Houston world of Apollo had far more capacity in breadth and depth than we did have in the network. Maybe not be true, but anyway, that was what came through to me. So when I came back from that visit, I decided that we should do something in the way of doing better on-site sims. The rationale being, as you just said, that you had to have a tremendous breadth and depth of backup capability for the manned flight mission. And I've expressed it, as you say, that on a nominal mission, which Apollo 11 was, for example, the network in Houston and everybody else used only about 5% of their capability. It was only on something like Apollo 13 where it got close to using about 90% of its capability.
Let's put the deep space side aside for the moment and start looking at the manned space flight, seeing you've mentioned that. Now, at this stage, you're the deputy for the deep space side, and Don Gray was the deputy for the manned space side, the wing. Now, how did you become to be involved in the manned space flight side?
Well, I was a Tidbin builder for about 18 months. I ran the operations on the Surveyor soft landing missions to the moon, which had a direct Apollo application in that they were proving a lot of lunar transit and lunar landings and tracking on the moon and getting communications back from the moon and the like. I'd also visited Goddard, just by the by, and helped work up some of the procedures that Apollo was thinking about for lunar operations, given that Goddard only ever had Earth orbit type experience to that point. So I had something unique to contribute. Anyway, the opportunity came, I can't remember the exact date, it would have been about August, September 67. I was asked if I'd like to move to Honeysuckle as the deputy. Tom Reed had just moved in there as the director, and I jumped at it. I was ready for a change anyway. 18 months was a nice length of time. I knew I'd have a lot to contribute given my sort of lunar experience ex Tidbin Biller, and I enjoyed operations. I found it relatively easy, and that's all subject on itself. Some people like operations and are good at it, and it's nothing to do with intelligence. And some people dislike operations and are hopeless at it, and again, nothing to do with intelligence. Some people are natural, some people aren't. Another slight digression. I spoke with Department of Defense, I spoke with Department of Civil Aviation for us to try and find objective ways of finding whether a person was suitable for operations or not. And I never ever succeeded. And the only way it could be done was to just put people in slots and put them under operational pressure and see how they performed. And if they didn't perform, then you'd try and find a slot for them somewhere else.
This was still a formative period for Honeysuckle, wasn't it?
Well, it turned out it was. I'm not fully aware of what happened before I arrived, but I know there'd been some problems, and there's certainly been some criticism of the station's performance by a NASA simulation team. And somebody decided to move Tom Reed in as director and me as deputy to, stiffen up, alter, change, improve the place. And Tom Reed and I worked very hard together to, first of all, identify what we thought were the shortcomings and what to do about them.
Can you describe your impressions of the station when you first arrived there?
It was different from, very different from Tidbinbilla. Tidbinbilla was comfortable, confident, knew what it was doing, and life was straightforward. At Honeysuckle, I won't say there was a panic mode, but there was a great uncertainty and lack of confidence in the people. And also immaturity in some of the equipment, and immaturity in the operational practices and procedures as well, because which is not surprising.
Because at this stage we hadn't done a manned mission.
That at that stage you hadn't tracked anything other than some of the surveyors and
lunar orbiters.
But the my recollection is the biggest problem with Honeysuckle when I arrived was it lacked confidence. It lacked confidence in itself, and it was doing things that Goddard were asking it to do, which the people knew were inappropriate, but nevertheless, because the great God Yank across the Pacific was saying, do this, then you did it. Now, Bob Leslie across at Tidbinbilla had raised me along the lines that says, look, you don't necessarily and automatically do what's asked from over there. They're only ordinary people at the other end of the line. Just because they have an American accent and they may have been in the space because a year or two longer than you, doesn't mean they necessarily know better than you in your environment. And my aim, mine and Tom's aim, was to get the Honeysuckle people to think like that, to back their own confidence.
I can give you an example of that, because I remember Jerry Soffin, who was the one of the leaders of the Viking mission, mm-hmm. he came across and he had no idea what a handover meant. That's a good example.
Yep. So it didn't take too long at all. There was a bit of coincidence, and obviously there was natural evolution happening whether I arrived or not at Honeysuckle. But as I say, I put it over a period of 6 months or so, confidence built up. And so by the time we got to Apollo 7, which would have been, a year after I arrived, I suppose, thereabouts, I was comfortable and confident that the station.
We'd done some more simulations with George Harrison.
Yes. But when it came to S-band communications and point the antenna in the right place at the right time, airplanes have only got a limited use. In some ways, they're good because they give you a worse experience than you're actually going to have on the space.
Only for the back end. It was the front end that suffered. They didn't have any practice.
That's right.
Tracking an aircraft, nothing like tracking a spacecraft.
No. There was some trepidation when Apollo 7 came up. It was the first live manned program that Honeysuckle had been involved in. But as I recollect it, everything went sweet and smooth from the station's point of view. The thing that you worried about was it was an 85-foot diameter antenna, which is not the optimum dish for near-Earth or Earth-orbiting type support. And it is as much a black art as a science in pointing that in the right place, acquiring the signal, and getting the signal in the middle of the main beam. And even today, at Tidbinbilla, it's still a black art to do it efficiently and quickly. But anyway, we learnt on Apollo 7, and of course, when you've got a regular Earth orbiting mission, you're doing it several times a day, and you get some experience up pretty quickly. So then we moved on to then somewhere in that period we didn't know we were going to support a lunar mission that soon. There was not talk about having a lunar mission as early as Apollo 8, i.e. at the end of 1968.
Well, that was a surprise for everybody, I think.
You can read some of the histories in other places that there were high power decisions being made, I think you mentioned in your book, behind the scenes that we certainly weren't privy to. And my recollection was we didn't really know until about 2 months before the mission that there was to be a lunar mission. Now, that was a big deal because we recognised that we would be the prime, the crucial. You know, we weren't just an add-on station. And for the very first time, all these lunar procedures and practices, which had only ever been talked about, and communication margin sums, which, you know, were all theoretical, were actually going to be put into practice. And I recognise it was going to be a real challenge to support Apollo 8. And the spotlight and focus would be on us, really, for the first time. Because on Apollo 7, most of the action seemed to occur over Carnarvon. I think Apollo 7, I have an idea, it still had UHF capability on board, as well as S-band. And all the old flight controllers were comfortable and happy with that, being ex-Gemini. This funny S-band stuff.
Carnarvon was a seasoned campaigner at this
and
stage.
And Carnarvon, was comfortable.
And it was their field, Earth Orbit was their field.
Exactly. So we were along for the ride on Apollo 7, but I knew that would all change dramatically in Apollo 8, which it did. And for the first time, the manned flight was coping with passes that went on, literally continuously, 8-10 hours at a time. A lot of the procedures just didn't hang in there. They were all oriented to Earth orbit type practices. But they learned pretty rapidly. This was one of the good things of working with the manned flight network.
But everybody was learning. NASA was learning too.
Oh, that's true. But not only was everybody learning, no one had time to play bureaucrats or politics. You were so busy doing your own job you just got on with it, and you hoped and trusted and assumed, and you're 999 times correct, that everybody else was doing their job well and efficiently. And that was the beauty of the manned flight Apollo program. It was all happening so quickly. There wasn't time for any bureaucratic party games, political games, budget games. Everybody just did their job. They knew what they were supposed to do.
Actually, that applied right through Apollo. The pressure was always there. It never hesitated after Apollo 1, and they cleared the decks from Apollo 7 onwards. They just went head first.
From Apollo 7 onwards, the missions were at roughly 2-month centres. Mm. And I've said in other places that we were getting documentation for the next mission before we'd flown the previous one.
And we were getting modifications to the station to be done before.
Yeah. There was a tremendous challenge. I look at all these modern management methods where you're supposed to delegate down to, everybody to do their own responsibilities and make clear everybody has their own tasks to do. But that's exactly how we were operating in Apollo days, because there were so many things happening. They were happening so fast that you just had to rely on people being self-starting, doing their initiative, to achieve the total product. And in practice, certainly as far as Honeysuckle was concerned, as far as the whole manned flight network and the whole Apollo program was concerned, I never heard of anybody or any situation where that did not happen, where everybody did their job. So Apollo 8 was, as I say, memorable. The other thing that from that era which amuses me, I have listened to some tapes that were taken around there, and what struck me was our level of confidence, really quite frightening in some instances. On Apollo 11, for example, when we were handing over the uplink on the lunar module on the lunar surface, we'd never done this before. It had what we call an FM downlink and a PM uplink, and the procedures were not written for that. They were literally, the book wasn't written. And I hear myself talking on the network in telling Houston how we're going to do it. And them not understanding and asking them to pass things on to Goldstone, in the end said, let me talk to Goldstone, I'll tell them what we're going to do. And to listen to that confidence that we all had was really quite devastating. Anyway, Apollo 9 was a fascinating program in its own right. That was a check out the lunar module.
Before we leave Apollo 8, how do you rate Apollo 8 with Apollo 11? A lot of people feel that Apollo 8 had a lot more going for it as far as the first. There were a lot of firsts with Apollo 8. By the time Apollo 11 came along, the media made a big thing about stepping on the moon. But Apollo 8 really goes down in the annals of history to me as the same as Columbus and Cook and people like that and Antarctic explorers have been to the place for the first time.
I think that's all very true. I guess I don't have sufficient of a soul, I suppose, to think these things through, even now, let alone at the time. My concentration and fascination was with the technologies and the techniques that we were pursuing, though I do clearly remember the Christmas Day soliloquy. But again, my conscience, and it also applied in Apollo 11 and all the others, was I'm there to do a job. You know, I really can't afford the luxury of the distraction onto other areas. And so I tended to look on Apollo 8 as a technological operational challenge that we were playing a crucial, we were crucial players in. And it was a culmination of a couple of years, two or three years, of a lot of effort and energy at Honeysuckle. And so my focus was very much on the performance of the facility. Did you? Yes, it wasn't without it, and also yes, it was manned flight and all that, but it was similar to the survey missions which I'd been involved with at in the DSN. So,
now in Apollo 8, you actually spoke to the spacecraft. Can you tell us what happened there?
Oh, I can't remember the detail of it, and there's a tape somewhere which I can't at the moment find. But it the voice circuit from Houston had to be configured to go on the transmitter from the station up to the spacecraft. And unless all the right buttons were pushed and everything was working, there could be a gap between the voice coming from Houston and it actually getting on the transmitter. In this instance, that connect disappeared, broke, wasn't made, and I had no idea what the details
were. Was that in the middle of...
It wasn't, yes, it was during a conversation. So Houston, the network controller, who happened to be only Randall, who I happen to know, called up and said, give the spacecraft a call, tell them Houston will be with them momentarily. Well, I literally parroted that word, and I said, it was Anders I spoke to, I think, and said, Houston says they will be with you momentarily. And I always had a problem with that. The US, the Americans use the word momentarily in a different way to what I do anyway. By momentarily, he meant in a minute or two. Mm. By momentarily to me, it meant in a few seconds. So I was using a word which I knew, if it was up to me, I would not have used, because I knew it was saying the wrong information. But given that it was coming from Houston, and given that I knew the spacecraft people would understand it as a minute or two, I used it, but when I heard the tape, I stumbled over the word momentarily because it really went against the grain to use it. Right. But I did in the end. And I often use that as an example of one of the few, I don't know that many, but there's got to be a lot of them, where we use the language differently.
That's correct, yes.
Between the... One thing that came up a few years after Apollo was, someone once said to me out of Houston, look, you don't do what we ask at... Honeysuckle. I said, yeah, we do. We always pride ourselves on doing everything you want. And as we may debate and argue, we'll do it. And I said, well, do you remember such and such situation? I said, yeah. And you said to me, why don't you do so-and-so, so-and-so? And I thought, well, all right, why don't you to me means here's an idea. Think about it. If you don't want to do it, it doesn't matter. They said, well, we meant you to do it. I said, you didn't say that. I said, if you want me to do something, don't say, why don't you? I said, well, that's a polite way of asking you to do it or telling you to do it. I said, doesn't work. You'll have to be specific. Because to me, the phrase, why don't you, gives me the option as to whether I do or don't do something.
So you wonder what problems they have with people like the Spaniards.
Well, it may be better, because when you've got a foreign language, you know you're talking different languages. But... what bothers me, another beautiful one that has led to misunderstandings, is the phrase to table something. Right. If an American talks about tabling something, they mean literally shelve it. It means put to one side. Right. It has the opposite meaning. And of course, generally, as you know, when we use table, it means up for active consideration. And I'm aware of several really gross misunderstandings through the misuse of that. Of course, the reversing of dates always leads to confusion. I mean, what bothers me are not the ones that I know about, it's the ones I don't know about.
That's right. What effect you've had back there that you don't know about.
Yeah.
Now, you started a local directive. Now, NASA brought out a 3-volume procedures document. Now, you initiated a station within the Honeysuckle station, a document called the HOD. Can you describe how you went about...
To me, it was all simple, logical, and straightforward. But I find, in retrospect, there's a lot of hoo-ha over this. I'd done something similar to Tibbin Biller. Well, Tibbin-Miller, for example, the surveyor mission, the volume of literature was measured by the foot shelf. We had, I think, about 10 foot shelves worth of documentation to support surveyor. And when I first arrived, and I've been told by Bob Les, I was in charge of operations, and Paddy Johnson, who was the
ops supervisor
there, showed me this lot of surveyor literature. I thought, God, what? He says, don't worry. There's only about 10 pages that's relevant, you know. And he was right. And of course, there were many things relevant that weren't in the document. So it wasn't only a question of sorting out the data that you needed, that there was data literally not there or ambiguous.
Well, because a lot of that data was for the general network, not specific to a particular station.
That's right, and written by people who didn't, and also written by people who didn't know anything about stations. Yeah. So I convinced Tom soon after I arrived that for many different reasons, it was worth extracting, abstracting, and originating on-station procedures in a book that was on-station controlled. It would never conflict with the official documentation. Never. It would never counter it. And as far as the outside world's concerned, we would never, ever, in any way, change the external reporting or external interfaces. And it would also have an initiative and a training role as well. And another role, especially with the computer people, who always had their little black books, and each computer operator had his own little black book with different
things. I had my own little black book.
Yeah, everywhere. I said, what I want is to provide a home for the little black books and to try and cross-feed and cross-learn between different operators.
Because at this stage, we had to look at shift handovers. We only had two shifts.
Mm-hmm.
But
you
had to have a shift handover where the previous shift had to know what the...
Well, that's right. And of course, the countdown, or SRT as it was called, was only documented in the broadest of senses by Goddard. And initially, of course, tended to be Carnarvon-oriented and not the 85-foot stations. And so we did a great deal in working up our own SRT.
You not only did that, but you had a very complicated system making sure it was up to date, the updating procedures.
Well, yeah, we tried, and of course you were very intimately involved in. I wanted to make sure that when a change went into the book, the people who needed to know knew a change had been made and knew where the change was, because it's quite dangerous to have. It may be neat and tidy bureaucratically to put in a nice clean change page, but unless the user can tell where the changes have occurred, then it can be worse than useless. It can be dangerous.
And it worked very well.
Well, I think it worked well, but I was biased. But I know there's a lot of flack and grumbles and mutters and grumbles around the place, but I didn't care, frankly, because I knew what I was doing. I knew why I was doing it. I knew it was working. And I guess what I'm saying is I was doing my job in the single-minded way that I saw it, as other people were doing their jobs in the single-minded way they saw it. But it stood the test of time, and one of the technicians in the computer area...
Brian Sullivan
was one of the great criticizers of the Harden, saw it as a big waste of time, didn't see why he couldn't have his little black book. Anyway, he left Honeysuckle. When he left Honeysuckle, he joined the TAB here in Canberra. And I saw him a few months later. He says, guess what? He said, I've started a hard type document in the TAB. They really need one. So he did a similar...
Actually, the principles and concepts could be used throughout industry in places like that for disseminating information.
Well, I think so. If you're in an organisation which is an umbrella organisation, which tries to publish things that cover all elements of it, they will never, ever cover your or a particular discrete area. Mm. And you can easily write out a few guidelines that say, okay, there will be a local document. It will not conflict with the master document. It will supplement it. Yeah. It will remove ambiguities. It may go into more detail somewhere. And where the external interface isn't impacted, it may change things significantly. For example, one thing we did at Honeysuckle, which horrified some parts of the manned flight network, was to change all the names of all the positions and all the intercom loop names, which again were a throwback to the manned flight days. And we had an intercom loop called the M&O loop, and we had a position called the M&O. And you had to say, this is M&O calling USB 1 on M&O loop.
Mm.
And I said to Tom, Tom, this is crazy. There's no reason to call it M&O loop. We want to get the chatter down and the volume of info down. Let's call it the A loop, alpha loop. And let's shorten everybody's titles.
And you went from M&O to OPS, if I remember right.
Let's shorten everything to the extent possible. And Tom agreed. So we did this. Now, we changed nothing externally. So calls to and from Houston, there was no difference. But when the Goddard and Houston training teams came through, they were horrified. And there were some political noises that we'd sort of were violating the integrity of the network by doing this. But Tom and I vehemently protested that we weren't in any way. This was purely a domestic in-house thing. And that not only were we allowed to do that thing, we were required to do what we saw fit to operate the place efficiently. And we got by, but that in a nutshell shows the floss that least that Din and Reed had. We saw it as our responsibility and to make the place run as efficiently as necessary, you know, as it could be. But we would religiously keep the external interfaces constant.
Now, you were also responsible for commencing the simulation systems, weren't you?
Well, sort of. In one context, the CSQ ship was decommissioned in Fremantle. I can't remember what year that was. And anyway, I was tasked to go over and look at it and see if there was anything on board that we could usefully use at Honeysuckle. And this was not long after I'd been at Houston and realized that their level of simulation was way above ours. They have a whole division at Houston that do simulations.
But at that stage, were we doing in-house simulations?
No. Well, a little, not very realistic.
We were relying on the Goddard simulations.
Largely. Not very realistic, because it is difficult to get good simulations going without investing a lot of money. So over a period of 2 or 3 years, and I can't remember really where we got it going, and I know it evolved right out into Skylab, but we got these consoles out of the CSQ, and with a lot of people doing a lot of smart things in jury rigging, amplifiers and mixers and the like, we did evolve a system whereby we could simulate every Apollo spectrum. And it was very important to do that, because each type of spectrum had to be handled quite differently in terms of receivers, demodulators, decommutators and computers. And you didn't want to be doing that for the first time on a live spacecraft. And
but the simulation would also prepare us for the Goddard simulations. We'd be much more
prepared. Well, that's true. Much better prepared, constructive.
Because they were always bringing out new procedures.
Yep.
The equipment
was
always changing. And we had to practice these somewhere.
It also helped us work up configurations and contingency configurations and give people a level of confidence, because when you coped with hard simulations, actual missions were dead straightforward.
That's the trouble with Apollo 11. People ask you what happened. We say, well, nothing, because was simulations, all the fun happened.
That's a fair comment. Anyway, so chronologically, we did Apollo 9 with no trouble. That was good fun, because the wing, the manned flight wing at Tibbenbilla, had to cope with tracking the lunar module in Earth orbit, which it did, screaming across the sky. By this stage, by the way, Don Gray was the station director at Tibbenbilla. Mm. That was an interesting mission. Apollo 10... I suppose in many ways it was like Apollo 8 to us. We'd no lack of confidence by this stage. And if you want to use a general comment, the station by this stage had bags of confidence, and the network had lots of confidence, and Houston had lots of confidence.
Mm.
Well,
by this stage we knew we could go around the moon.
And everybody was young. Everybody was in their 30s. There was no one old, and youth was certainly a factor here. One could maybe argue in retrospect that there should have been more caution and some more conservative heads in the act, but anyway, the results were delivered.
Well, we had to abide by the president's decision. Everybody was even from that, from the top of NASA. Yeah, we were all following what the president had said by 1970.
Yeah, and as I say, we all worked at it. We all knew what we were doing. I don't reckon there were never any budget problems that I recollect. Certainly, it didn't impinge on me. If I needed something, Tom Reed and I had a very good working relationship. If I needed something, I get Tom's agreement to it. It happened.
But you also had backing from the States too. I mean, it also had backing from the States.
Oh yeah.
I remember in Apollo 8, we had a failure up in the antenna, and they went to great lengths to fly out special parts from.
I found the manned flight network the most satisfying one to work with, more so than the deep space network. We were listened to, and in fact, I found out years afterwards that they used to send us the manuals first off. We were the first ones distributed with the next mission's manuals. Mm-hmm. They said, well, we'll wait for Din and Co. to come back and tell us what's wrong with them. I didn't know that at the time, because we always used to feedback within 2 days of getting the manuals. We'd send back an enormous message listing all the problems of the manuals. And they'd say, yeah, okay, change them. Next edition would come out quickly. And it seems that wasn't coincidence. That ended up being a planned, because the fellow who ran the operations out of Goddard in those days, Bill Wood, eventually ended up as the NASA rep out here in Canberra in the late 70s, early 80s.
Actually, you've preempted one of my later questions, is what the impression of Australian tracking stations was back there, from your point of view.
Well, from whenever I've heard it, I've never, ever heard any criticism whatsoever of the Australian ones. And in fact, I think it's always been the opposite. That we've been held up as the more positive example. And I've developed a phrase recently when I'm talking, describing a Tidbinbilla, for example, as one of the best stations in the network. Let the others fight over whether they're one as well. But we had a rapport working with them. Obviously, the language was no problem. Can play with Madrid. The whole system was well set up by the people in the early 60s. I don't really know who to class as the biggest contributors to that. Lloyd Bott, who was a deputy of Department of Supply, appeared to have a big effect, and Ian Homewood, who was in Department of Supply. And by big effect, I mean getting the working relationship such that we, Australia, would do what we were capable of doing. And if we needed help, we'd ask for it. But we didn't need to be told what to do in detail.
Now, while you're mentioning that, could you describe your impressions or effects of interfacing with the local government?
I really didn't have anything to do with that in that era, to be frank.
But they did support us, didn't they? Or did they have not much to do with us?
Well, they would have had a lot to do with it, and the siting of the helping to find the sites and putting in the roads and the like, which were paid for by NASA, mind you. But there was a good relationship with NCDC. There was a good relationship with the Department of Interior. I've heard it said, and I don't know how true it is, that Menzies reputedly said he wanted these three new tracking stations in the ACT as part of his working up the Canberra region. I can't remember who told me that, and I certainly can't point you to any documented reference, but it does fit in with what Menzies wanted to see happen in Canberra.
Yes, well, I find it interesting when you look back on the history of it. The first stations were at Mushay and Woomera. Well, now, Woomera is a logical place because it was attached to an already military space establishment, so you had the right background. Mushay, I think, was a locational situation where they wanted a station fairly close after insertion into orbit. Then they found they had problems with Woomera, its isolation, getting people to work there. Mushay wasn't so bad, but then they found it was a little bit too far south, so they wanted something closer to the equator, so they decided to move north to Carnarvon. Now, once again, we've gone to a very isolated community there, and getting good people to work out in those places. I think the station director at one time, Ray Jacob, made this comment that only people who wanted to go there would work in these places. And so I think there was a big element there of getting the right people and giving them an environment they could comfortably live in. And I think Canberra fitted that.
Well, that's true, and it certainly gave stability. Although Canberra is not the optimum location compared with Madrid and Goldstone. We are too close to Goldstone and too far away from Madrid. And if you look at any of these timelines that show the overlaps, you'll see the overlap with Madrid is always very short. The overlap with Goldstone is always very long. So geographically, this station should have been further west.
I think another factor there too was the good communications, easy access to overseas communications too.
Those days. That's true.
Without satellites.
The question of the location of Tidbinbilla is picked up in the Deep Space Network history. His name.
But that's why we Corliss, wasn't it?
Sorry,
Corliss. I think he was. I think you see, we had three. All three networks had their stations in the ACT, the Stadan, MSFN, and Deep Space.
Yeah,
which I guess says something.
By the MSFN had to follow the DSN because somebody decided that the two had to be co-located.
Right.
Anyway. So the sides have worked out quite well and still are good, although we're just starting to have the odd few problems of with the modern method of looking at a spectrum of protecting the frequency bands.
Okay, now we've reached Apollo 10 and we're looking at Apollo 11. Were you involved in the inclusion of parks?
Not very actively. That was administered out of Tidbinbilla. Because it was recognised that they would have the resources during an Apollo mission to help work with parks. And I had my hands full at Honeysuckle. So other than visiting parks, which I do plainly remember doing in, must have been 68, 69, and there were tens of k's of dirt between Canberra and parks in those days, and meeting John Bolton. And I knew the fellow who was involved most from Goddard in terms of the equipment planning was Bob Taylor, who we all knew well. He was the USB engineer out of Goddard. So operationally, what Parks meant to me was two more receivers, and we christened them 9 and 10.
Another antenna.
Complications of the video being selected in at Sydney, but my outlook on parks and Sydney was operations. I was single-mindedly focused on operations and was not concerned how things were happening.
Right. Now, as you're going to Apollo 11, can you tell us your problems you're facing this mission? Can you tell us your thoughts and your problems and how you approached this momentous occasion?
Believe it or not, the biggest problem we had pre-mission, as far as I was concerned, was the media. That as the Apollo missions have become more and more media worthy, we're getting more and more requests, understandable, and disruptions in the station in trying to cope with all the requests. So I had a brilliant idea. I said to Tom Reed one day, I said, Tom, let's have a media day. One day, when the place will do nothing but respond to media.
And this is before the mission?
Before the mission. Mm. And the antennas can wave around the sky, the magnetic tape reels can spin and the lights can flash, and the technicians can use whatever ingenuity they want to come up with fascinating things that the media like. Because you've got to have lights, flashing, movements, noise, sound. And understandably, that's what...
And they don't like a steady antenna tracking sidereal rates.
You know, the antenna always has to slew across the sky at great speed. And that happens not only in the space in our business, but you watch any movie, any documentary, and if you happen to have more little passing knowledge of what's happening, you realise it's not the genuine thing. So we did that, and we media from all over the place. I remember we had a fellow from Japan who kept show, was there 24 hours. He took our 24 hours, literally. And he was bobbing up behind console, you know. But once we got the media out of the way, we could concentrate on the mission. And I personally didn't have any great qualms. I mean, we were all full of supreme confidence. We were full of supreme confidence in the Apollo Saturn hardware because nothing, so as we knew anyway, had hiccuped in any shape or form at all. Not out of the way, but we weren't aware of it. We'd had no problems on station that we hadn't been able to cope with. We'd had no problems on station that I can recollect of consequence. Or at least that we couldn't cope with. We had enormous number of staff, of course. We had about 130 people at Honeysuckle.
But still only two shifts. Yeah, cover 24
true.
Hours.
But with a person sitting in front of every receiver, right. for example, and every exciter and every DMOT, the number of people, the depth and magnitude of resources to find faults and fix faults was enormous.
Mm.
And so... I had no qualms in going into Apollo 11. And again, we were all so busy, you didn't really have time to sit back and think and philosophize, or I didn't anyway.
Did you do any special preparations for it?
I don't recollect doing so, to myself. I mean, the program had worked out well. Apollo 8 had given us lunar distance and orbital operational practice. 9 had given us communication with lunar modules, and had 10. The only thing we hadn't any experience we certainly hadn't had television from the lunar module, as I recollect. So there was some thought and preparation about how parks would be used and how we could simulate. There was a lot of talk about how parks would point at the lunar module, and Tom Reed quite rightly said, "Look, if the world," and John Bolton was that. John Bolton was one of the world's leading radio astronomers. Can't point at a particular place on the moon, then we should give the whole thing away.
Mm.
And we effectively told NASA that. You know, they wanted to bring in lots of procedures. Said, look, let John Bolton point that and tender that spacecraft. End of discussion. And that's the way it went.
Mm. Mm. Because they had their problems with the wind just at that time, which we nobody expected.
Oh, so it seems.
At the beginning, but apparently it settled down afterwards. Yeah. Okay, so we go into Apollo 11. Can you describe your feelings on the launch day?
I can't remember what I was doing on launch day.
Because the whole station, all these missions, we used to devote our whole lives. Once the mission started, there was little else you could do.
Oh, true. Your day was completely filled.
Revolved completely around the mission.
You know, the launch went off on time. I think I remember driving down the hill from Honeysuckle and listening to Bob Leslie on the ABC radio as the local technical expert, as they were doing the TLI, translunar injection, over Carnarvon. It wasn't visible from Honeysuckle.
Can you describe the atmosphere of the station when you came on shift during that July 21st day? Just your impressions as you walked in the room and what happened?
Well, everything had gone exactly as advertised, and we were at that stage would have been more surprised if they hadn't. One expected things. We had the timeline, we had the flight plan, and we expected everything to happen per the flight plan. So I think John Gorton had been through before I came on board on.
Yes, he came through during the SRT.
Yeah. We tended to split the duty. I'd not mentioned Ian Grant at any stage during all this. Ian Grant came on as a second deputy, and I can't remember exactly when, but during these 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 missions, he used to handle the SRT side of it, and I took on generally as we were just finishing the SRT and starting the pass ops.
So what were you actually doing on the console during this period?
Well, what I'd been doing for the last two or three years, basically. That was the reason it was so fairly simple.
But what were your functions? Yeah.
It was simply to coordinate the activities, make sure the station was configured, and doing all the things that were asked of it, using a combination of some displays, indicators, meters, lights, and a lot of audio reports and questions, and trying to keep the balance right in not telling people how to do the job and they knew how to do it, but just making sure that things were being done. And what's more, people were anticipating. The secret of good space tracking, and I might say most things in life, is not to be caught surprised. You should have in mind what can happen, and you should have some plan in your mind.
That's what simulations are about, isn't it?
Well, it is, but but it's also a state of mind that you've got to get people into, is that they're not... It's like sport, I suppose. You don't just lay back in your laurels when you've achieved what you've got to do for that particular minute. You should be thinking and looking ahead, and you should have a lot of what-ifs in mind. And you should be doing intelligent things like listening to other people, listening to intercom loops, listening to the chit-chat with the spacecraft, and so you might pick up the first hint of any problems or novels, or are the commands getting up, is the voice coming down. There's a great deal can be done. There's a lot separates a real smart operator from a just competent operator.
Mm. Did you speak to anybody in NASA about Apollo 11 and the honeysuckle's functions at all?
Not especially. I mean, we got all sorts of pretty messages afterwards. We did everything expected of us. As I say, the most memorable thing for me was this business of how the heck to hand over the lunar module from Goldstone to Honeysuckle. By hand over, changing the uplink, the transmitter, from one to the other, because it only pinged with us just soon before it was going to happen that we did not have a procedure. No one had foreseen the combination we were in. The practice was to sweep the uplink, tune, wave the frequency about on the transmitted signal and watch for that signal to come back down from the spacecraft when the spacecraft was in what's called coherent mode. Generally. It was not in this mode. It had an FM downlink because it had television on it. And we'd all overlooked that. And so we had to come out with a procedure in real time to cope with that. No big deal, but an example of we weren't infallible.
Okay, now you said that you expected everything to go per the procedures, but there's one mission that they didn't. That was Apollo 13.
Apollo 13 was by the way, Apollo 12 was natural and normal for us, except we saw he was going to burn the camera out when he was waving it around, and we put that was put down partly due to the time delay of the between the Capcom and the astronauts. But Apollo 13 was, I say, the only mission where, well, in particular, the receiver operators earned their money, and put me on the spot real badly. And I've often used it as an example of, I still don't know if I did the right thing. When the accident occurred of the explosion of the fuel cell in the service module, they had to use the lunar module as the lifeboat, i.e. turn on the lunar module and use its communication links back to Earth. The trouble for us was that the third stage of the Saturn V rocket, namely this S4B, transmitted on the same frequency. And although the spacecraft had separated from the S4B, they were both on a trajectory to the Moon. And so when they fired up the lunar module, we had both signals, the S4B and the lunar module, in the same bandwidth, and the receivers could lock to one or the other, and did. However, as I said before, there was what's called this coherent method of handling frequencies. If you transmit on one, transmit and capture the receiver on board the spacecraft, you can then tune the transmitter, and that allows you to pull away the downlink frequency. And we succeeded in doing this. So we pulled the frequencies apart between the S4B and the lunar module, and we got good communications going. I might say by this stage we had Parks up in a matter of a couple of hours. John Bolton threw the radio astronomers off and got Parks pointing. It wasn't due to support that
mission. So I remember that, hearing that on the loop at the time, we heard this conversation going on, and suddenly down one of the lesser loops came this, how long would it take to get Parks up? And we said, oh, 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And
they were prepared. It was not right. Listen, what we're going to